Stay tuned for To Your Health on WPBC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here's your host, MC Blair.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, this is MC Blair here. Welcome to Your Health. Wonderful Saturday morning, nice and clear, about 84 degrees here at WPVC. And I am with Dr. Anna Maria Cigariz and Dr. Sybil Kranz from UVA. And we're going to be talking about the first 1,000 days of life. That's their area of expertise. And children's health and what they eat and all that. So I'm just going to toss it over to Dr. Cigariz and just tell us a little bit about your research and how, you know, maybe how you feel it's very important. I know you do. So I think it's your passion.
Great. Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Basically, what I've been able to do over the last 20 or so years with my research is to demonstrate how it's really important for us to be able to set children off on the right trajectory. And it really begins during pregnancy and maybe even preconceptionally, because how we eat and our ability to know when we become pregnant is very, very low. As we know, 50% of all pregnancies are unplanned. So the more that you can eat healthy while you're just living an everyday normal life and then become pregnant, the more likely you are to have the right dietary intake of mm-hmm. both nutrients and supplements to be able to form an optimal child. And then it's really important, and the most recent paper that we just published in Pediatric basically shows that from birth to 24 months of age, that some children in the United States do really well in terms of how their parents are feeding them from zero to about a year, mm-hmm. When kids are, you know, just learning how to even chew and swallow, that we tend to protect our infants from, you know, consuming the typical American diet. But then once they hit 1 year of age, in that second year of life is when they start learning how to really become a family member. And if the family isn't eating healthy, then you really are sort of setting that child up for these preferences for high fat, high sugar, high refined carbohydrates, which is really what Sybil's sort of expertise runs mm-hmm. into in terms of how kids are from that point in time really take off in their eating habits. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, Sybil?
Yes. Well, thank you. As Anne Maria said, one of the important factors in children forming food preferences and knowing what, you know, is a normal meal, because just like anything else, children have to learn from observation and from trying out what is considered normal for them. So I think part of where we sometimes maybe tend to fail our kids is that most mothers and fathers know in theory what a good diet would be like, but that's not necessarily what's on the table. That's not necessarily how they eat. And the importance of role modeling, and not just for the mothers, also of the fathers, is unbelievably powerful. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it's this typical, you know, tell the kids to eat the spinach, and then you turn around and, you know, have some treats yourself, right. Which we all have done.
Right.
It's just human nature. So this disconnect is a little bit what I'm trying to go after, and I'm trying to figure out ways of how we can improve children's diet quality. And it's a slow process. It mm-hmm. has to go step by step. But it can be done.
Yeah, I think City Schoolyard Garden is, and the Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville are doing wonders for the communities, especially the less fortunate, and educating them and getting them out. And, of course, those are older children, obviously, but, you know, they're going to have little brothers and sisters probably down the road, and this can maybe get the family started at least on that road.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I think is really mind-boggling when we think about it is how many times does a child have to try a food before they actually decide whether or not they're going to eat it routinely? What do you think?
You know, I'm not sure. I know that a lot of kids are plopped in front of a television to, you know, that's the electronic babysitter, we call it, and naturally they get inundated with these ads for all these great foods. They taste so good. So that can certainly influence them in their diet or their dietary choices. Or their mommy when they're young, I want this, you know. But I think that if you know you switch them from you know some added sugar product, low in dietary fiber, to broccoli, that's a tough call. Now I was a kitchen manager in a school in the cafeteria, and our byline was, add cheese to anything, they'll eat it. You know, right?
Right.
So
right.
You can, you know, maybe that's a way to get them to do it. Put a little cheese on there, and then maybe back off on that as, you know, as time goes by, unless it's a, you know, really high quality local cheese. But most of it is, you know, some sort of added, you know, sugar product.
Or fat,
in exactly.
In a cheese case. But,
right, yeah.
So, you know, what's interesting is there is actual research that shows that you have to give a child something between 10 and 12, right, Sybil?
Yeah.
10 and 12 exposures to a new food before
wow.
the child actually develops a preference for that particular food. And I think most of us as parents sometimes think, okay, I'm going to serve green beans, you know, to my child. The child tastes it and makes this funny face, especially
right.
as a little child, like an infant, right? And you're like, oh, he doesn't like green beans. But the reality is you have to serve the food repeatedly for them to begin to get those taste
preferences.
Well, that
makes sense.
Right? And just like anything in life, it's better to train a child how to eat fruits and vegetables than it is to all of a sudden do exactly what you were just recommending, which a lot of us have done, trust me.
Yeah.
You know, just add something and then try to take it away.
Right.
So if a child develops a preference for vegetables, because fruits tend to be sweet, so most kids will eat fruits as babies, but vegetables, that's one of the things we found in our study in pediatrics that we just got published, is that 20% of infants and that's from 6 months to 12 months of age, do not consume any vegetables on any given day. That means nothing. And, you know, it's a shame because that's when we need to be teaching them how to actually develop a taste for vegetables. So why don't you talk a little bit more about taste preferences, Sybil, because I know you've done work in that area.
Oh, I just wanted to tell our audience they're listening to Your Health here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and Dr. Sybil Kranz from UVA is about ready to talk about the...
Take the ball and run with it.
Take the ball and run. There you go.
Yeah, so in essence, if you think about a child's life, the first food is breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
And then little by little, once we can start adding other foods, by 6 months, it's recommended to wait until about 6 months. Basically, what we're trying to do here is forming a future adult, one food at a time. So the first foods that are being introduced, and you know, there are various recommendations for how this works, but they tend to be cereals or fruits, mm-hmm. pureed fruits. So very commonly, vegetables are later, they're down the line, and the child learns to like these foods that they're exposed to and then accept them in the diet, because that's really the crux of the whole thing, is that once a child has accepted a food as being part of his or her diet, it's fine. They will eat it.
Mm-hmm.
But that barrier has to be overcome. And a child, especially ages around two, they go through phases of neophobia, where they don't like any new foods. They are afraid of those foods. They rather go hungry than eat a food that they don't know. So there are tricks on how to overcome those, like Anna Maria mentioned, 10 mm-hmm. to 12 exposures. So one of the tricks, for instance, is to put it on the plate and say right away, try it, but you don't have to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of lower the fear. don't push the child that they have to eat it, and you know, or say, smell it, lick it, have a bite, and you can spit it out if you don't like it. But keep doing that. And with each exposure, which each time the child has that flavor on their tongue, the chances are that this food will be accepted into the diet. It's frustrating for the parents because they have waste. You know, that very often, if it's local fresh vegetables, they were expensive too, maybe. And they really want the child to eat it and gobble it up. But, you know, it's worth waiting it out. It's worth trying it and just put up with the waste. Eventually, the child will learn to like that food. So this is for healthy foods, and the same mechanism works for the not-so-healthy foods. But there, like high sugar-sweetened things or lots of fat and salt, like when you add cheese to items, you just add salt and fat, basically, which improves the flavor. But those foods are accepted faster, but the mechanism for the child to like the food is exactly the same. Try it carefully the first time and then decide, do I want to try this again? Yes. Or is this already accepted into the diet? And with things that are very sweet or very salty and greasy, it's just a much shorter period until they're accepted.
Yeah, I believe that.
And you cannot unlearn that. You cannot unlearn that. Once the child likes the birthday cake, it likes the birthday cake.
It's like the imprint.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the other thing that you mentioned in reference to some of these community gardens and these different programs in schools is the fact that if you can get the child, even starting at a young age, with you to sort of help you prepare the food, to see how it's grown, to be able to harvest it, bring the child into the food preparation, it really sort of makes them more comfortable. They sort of see where it comes from, and it sort of brings the whole family together in terms of making that food an experience for the family to have together.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's, you know, you hear the quality time stressed all the time, and you know, parents, as young parents especially, well, what is that? You know, is that a family vacation? Well, that costs money. Is it going to the mall? That costs money. What can we do? What is quality time? And there it is, if you get the kids involved in food prep.
Yes.
You know?
And I want to mention here that there have been a number of studies that show that many children do not know anymore where the food comes from. So if you say, where does a strawberry come from? Well, it comes in that little plastic bucket where we buy it in the store, or, you know, vegetables. Well, they're in the freezer. They don't understand anymore where the food comes from. So just little things like having a strawberry plant in a pot on your windowsill in your kitchen.
Good idea.
They can grow it. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take a lot of space or so. But then the child will also have this pride of ownership. Like, I watered this plant. These are my strawberries. I made this.
Oh,
and then they're very
so
likely to
sense.
Eat it.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. They take ownership in it, which is just a wonderful thing. What a good idea. I've never even thought about that. You know, I always said, well, take them on a field trip to a local farm, which they can also do.
Absolutely,
And just have a ball. I know I was at, what is the name? Oh, I feel terrible. I go there all the time. I just went completely blank. Anyway, I went to the farm, and this farmer has an outreach program with the local schools, and he does field trips all the time, and they educate the kids. And when I was there, when I first pulled up, they were doing exactly that. There was a school bus there and a lot of kids and all that, and it was just laid back, and you could tell the children were having a ball. So that's another way that kids can get used to. But I love your idea of, especially in an urban setting, you know, have that window box with you know,
tomatoes,
lettuce, or tomatoes, or little strawberries, whatever, for the sweet. You know, and you can teach. Then you can also have, I just thought you could have two. You could have one strawberry plant, and as it almost gets ready for harvest, you know, when it gets too much water, it's not as sweet, right? So you could have one, and you water it a lot, simulating a real rainy season. And then the other one you don't, and they taste the difference, and they're, wow. I mean, there's a scientific experiment, right?
Oh, yeah.
Lots of our elementary school kids have to do exactly that.
Yeah, oh, right.
You know, and it also brings into the fact that, you know, our school system is, I believe, for the most part, really trying hard to teach kids about what healthy eating is, you know, and they usually come into the home and sort of translate that information once again to the parent to sort of say, this is what I'm learning in school. And if a parent can take advantage of that to help them sort of be introduced to new foods, and to also sort of work the message of, well, if you want your plants to grow healthy, you want it to have water, dirt with good nutrients, and sun, right? And so if you want to grow healthy, what do you need to eat? Well, you need to eat fruits and vegetables, you need to have your protein sources, you know, you need to drink water because that helps you grow,
right,
and be physically active.
Outside.
So, right,
have the
be
sun.
Outside
right.
to have the sun for that vitamin D exposure. So I think there's so many things that you can sort of translate into teaching a child how they should be able to take care of themselves by looking at how we take care of plants and animals.
Well, I was with Carter Wallace from Farfield's Farm, and he gets into, and it speaks to exactly what you were talking about, and it's not always just what you eat, it's how you eat it, you know, getting into the whole family, the whole farm, the soil, the sun, it's a living mechanism or entity, if you will, and that's it, you know. So if you get on that whole circle going, that it's just the kids own it. They feel a part of the family. Whereas, you know, a lot of families, it's like, hey, you're a kid, you know, seen and not heard and all that, the way I was raised. Well, yeah, this opens that whole thing up. And I think it would take some pressure off the parents when the kids were, you know, that little light bulb goes on and all of a sudden the parents are going, oh, yeah, I'm doing something right.
So, right.
You mentioned... As a matter of fact, you mentioned your latest publication, which was Trends in Food and Beverage Consumption Among Infants and Toddlers.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, kind of at the end, additional policy guidance and education for the parents and caregivers. We've got the schools, obviously. Any other way that can be achieved? I mean, policy guidance, doesn't that go to the city fathers, or is that what you're speaking of? Or?
So the policy guidance, I think, comes in many different shapes and forms. Mm-hmm. So it can start all the way from the food facts label, making sure that we have a label that individuals use and it's informative for when they're shopping and purchasing foods that are healthy for their child, and getting FDA, which is the organization that actually controls what's in the food facts label, mm-hmm. to give us that kind of information that we need, to also understanding what are the rules and regulations that different schools have to use for school breakfast and school lunch and aftercare programs, as well as to policy associated with what's in the WIC food package, the Women, Infant, and Children Supplemental Food Package,
right,
which is a program there to help pregnant, breastfeeding, and then children from the age of birth to 5 to be able to have some supplemental foods that are healthy foods in good amounts so that they can actually help the family and themselves to eat appropriately and to grow in the right sort of optimal frame that we really want them to have.
Oh, that's great.
And then the other aspect, too, is pediatricians, is to make sure that your physician, your nurses, your dentist, the pharmacist at Walgreens, you know, that everybody's really pitching in, trying to provide good, healthy messages about what is the right way to eat. What do you think about that, Sybil?
No, actually, I'm gonna stop you for a minute. We're gonna take a real quick break, and we will be back. This is MC Blair, To Your Health on 94.7. Hey, we're back. This is MC Blair, and you are listening to Your Health on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking to Dr. Anna Maria Sigariz and Dr. Sybil Kranz. And Sybil was about ready to answer how to get the healthcare professionals, the pharmacists, basically the community involved in, you know, this getting the kids to eat the right foods.
Right. Not just to get them.
Oops. Hang on. Oh, a little technical difficulty here. I don't understand.
Anna Maria, does your mic work? Wait a minute.
Okay. There we go. All right.
There's always that little plug, right?
I know.
Okay. Well, as Anna Maria mentioned, it does take a number of different areas. And if you think about it, it does take a community to raise a child. One person or one unit sending out a message will not necessarily lead to success. And especially when it comes to something like eating, if you think about all the places where we eat, and all the people who influence our food choice and the amount we're eating and just how we're eating. Do I gobble it down quickly or do I have time and sit down and enjoy it and really taste what I'm eating? So many places play a role there. First of all, of course, pediatricians and primary care physicians, the dentist. I mean, you know, dentists mentioning tooth health is really important. And
yes,
food and when we eat it has to do with dental health quite a bit. But also restaurants, for instance, or other places where we go and consume food in an exchange for money. So there's no self-preparation of any kind of food or choice of items involved. It's more like, you know, I take this meal or and so on. So what's offered there, how it is marketed and how it is presented as an attractive choice is really, really incredibly important. Because basically in the first, let's say, you know, between 2 and 5, children develop food preference for life. For many of them, it's for life. And there's a lot of messaging that's going on that has nothing to do with somebody actually stating the words. It's modeling, it's availability, it's price. There's all kinds of different mechanisms by which food choice is regulated. So one of the things we mentioned before was the family meal. But how about asking the children, you know, how do you feel about every Wednesday you pick what we have for dinner? Or every Saturday, or whatever the family's time frame is. And a lot of these responses will probably be guided what the child is used to mm-hmm. and what they think is the norm. And if you have an adventurous child that wants to have fun, they might recommend something that's never been there before. You know, maybe they have a Chinese friend in school who mentioned, I don't know, some meal that they never had. It might be something like that. So again, you have these influences from the outside that form a little bit how we perceive food to be and what we think is normal and what we want to try or not try.
So the community at large, exactly.
Yes.
And the wow.
So we call that in public health, when we think about all the different spheres of influence, we basically call that the socio-ecological model in public health. How the individual is at the middle of these circles, right? And then as you go out, each circle represents a different domain. So around the individual, you have the family. The next circle is usually like, you know, where we work and play. And then the next one is sort of like the communities that we live. And then it becomes even a bigger circle where you have food systems and you've got how the government gets involved, how our environment, climate change, how climate change is going to influence the foods that are available. And so all these different spheres really make an impact on us as individuals. And you can't just change an individual. In order for us to have lasting changes to how we eat in America, how we eat globally, we need to change every single one of these spheres to be able to support a healthy lifestyle.
Sociological.
Yeah. Sociological model. Yep.
Socio-ecological, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That. Oh, social.
Ecological.
Yes. Okay.
So that you bring in sort of the environment,
I got
ecology.
You. Yeah. So, but wow, so all the various, you know, spheres.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, my. That's great.
I can't say I developed it. Somebody much wiser than us, and we've used it in so many different examples.
So let's say I go to the pharmacy. Now, I happen to know my pharmacist, and we get along really good. And I've developed a barbecue sauce back using local and organic ingredients, and I took a bottle over to them, and they really liked it, and every once in a while I take them another bottle. I have their ear if I want it. So what could I say? You know, where could I, you know, how could I possibly get them thinking the healthy food way to maybe, you know, I'm at a loss.
Oh, you're
here.
Thinking of the pharmacist?
How can I influence the pharmacist so that then they will influence other people?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, pharmacy schools now are doing more training in nutrition.
Oh, okay.
They realize the connection between training pharmacists who are in the community, having a lot of day-to-day contact with their community members mm-hmm. and how that can influence their behaviors. So, for instance, if you have somebody with hypertension and you know they're coming in to pick up a medication that is there to control blood pressure, that a lot of those labels will say exactly what the medicine is for, and that provides an opportunity for the pharmacist to say, you know, you should be avoiding foods that are really high in sodium. You know, so that right there is an example. If you want to take something for a little child, if a mother is coming in and buying iron supplements, okay, because the child might be anemic, that might be another opportunity for the pharmacist to say, you know, it's good to take these supplements, but it's also good to make sure that your child is eating foods that are high in iron. Mm-hmm. Here are some vegetables that are high in non-heme iron, and if you, you know, consume them with vitamin C-rich foods, you're able to, you know, increase the bioavailability of those foods in the body. Or here are some protein foods that are really high in iron that'd be good to make sure your child's mm-hmm. eating. So I think it's through the conditions of the, what you're coming in to pick up those prescriptions that provides a unique opportunity for pharmacists to actually say, here are some things that you can do.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. Oh, my gosh. I was going to ask you about chemical fertilizer.
You can't ask us about chemical fertilizer because that's not our area.
The access your research. If any of our audience was interested in accessing your research, I know you gave me some links here, and if I, you know, National Academies of Science.org.
Right. So one of the things that was related to was once again the pediatrics article that basically shows that, you know, juices is like the number, you know, when we think about sugar sweetened beverages and juices and how they contribute to sugar intake among these very young kids, that, you know, 100% fruit juice actually can contribute a lot of sugar, so parents should watch how much they consume. And then the next beverage is sugar-sweetened beverages, soda intake. And so the National Academies of Sciences in a few weeks is going to have this workshop on how we can limit sugar-sweetened beverage intake among 0 to 5-year-olds, and it's bringing together all these different stakeholders, including the food industry, which is a wonderful sort of getting everybody at the table to protect the most vulnerable population. Mm-hmm. And so that actually is going to be available as a webinar.
Oh,
and people
great.
Can sign up for it. They go to the National Academy of Sciences and Medicine's website. And then all of our articles are available on PubMed, and so you can get it that way. And we also, if you go to the UVA website mm-hmm. and Google both Sybil's and I's name, you can sort of see what articles we've published and a description of our research work.
Right? Okay.
Sybil,
yeah.
Is there any other thing that would be a good resource?
But I think for parents looking for advice, there's always, you know, the known authorities who have very often nice resources, whether it be little videos or just check charts, like, you know, what should be in a lunch, and then you can check off the boxes and so on, to just make it easier.
That
I mean,
sense.
reading a scientific paper is a bit, you know, cumbersome.
True, I understand.
Even for people like, you know, we do this every day, but yep. it takes a long time and there's a lot of, you know, stuff involved. If I'm a mother of four, I might not have the time to do that.
Right,
so,
right.
But you could go to USDA.gov MyPlate,
mm-hmm. right.
which is a wonderful website that actually has translated the dietary guidelines for Americans into actionable points yeah. for the everyday person.
Right.
And it has it from, those dietary guidelines apply from kids from ages 2 all the way up to older age groups, and it really breaks it down into the number of food group servings you should have per week. You can track what
right.
you're eating.
And there's Team Nutrition, which is also a link on that site. They have a number of resources there as well. And it can be done online or it can be printed out. Mm-hmm. So the moms mm-hmm. can have it on the fridge and just check off, you know, did my child today have its green leafy vegetables? Check mark or not.
Right. Well, I went to the National Health and Nutrition
And Hanes.
Yeah, Hanes, mm-hmm. and Hanes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I got a list of foods high in dietary fiber.
All right.
Kind of check it off. And I want to encourage any of you listeners out there, when you do see the foods that are the best for you and your family, try to source them as much as possible through City Market. Or any farmer's market, especially when, you know, fresh, because fresh is always better, fresh and local. It's just way better for you, more nutrition.
Well, it's supporting our economy.
And it's supporting the economy.
So we're thinking
keeping the money
about
right here.
Keeping the money close by, also helping farmers who are doing an enormous amount of work to be able to grow these products right in our own backyard, basically.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like a give and take, right?
And then the families can support, it's called Community Supported Agriculture, CSAs. You can get a box of fresh local food delivered to various drop-off points that are accessible to you every single week.
Right.
So that's another way.
And another way is the farms that have to pick your own, whether it be strawberries or peaches.
Exactly.
Kids love that.
They do.
Absolutely love it, yes.
Right. And I also want to put a plug in there that our local grocery stores are also trying to buy more local food.
I've seen that.
And so I think the reality is it doesn't matter whether you shop at Food Lion or at Wegmans or Whole Foods or Nations, you know, Food for All Nations, you're going to see local products.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's wonderful. And we should probably try to encourage
our
local industries to do that.
Also, I've noticed, and I'm not sure if it's WIC, but I think it is, that you get credit for double your food allowance if you purchase from the City Market, and so all of a sudden that's the SNAP. Okay, you're
SNAP
right.
SNAP program.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
that just hit, and which all of a sudden these local foods, which instead of $1.50 a pound or $3 a pound, you can afford it because you're only paying your $1.50.
Right,
and so that's awesome that they have come out with that.
Very much so.
And in today's political climate, I don't know how long that's going to last, but hopefully it will. Hopefully it will, because that's common sense. Now, one of these things, you are listening to Your Health and here on 94.7 WPVC. You mentioned the 35% of adults, 50% of 65 and older have diabetes, and many more have pre-diabetes.
Yes.
So eating these right foods, especially the high in dietary fiber and low in fats, that's going to help that, right?
Yes, and I think you've had already in the past several segments on diabetes. So it's one of those diseases where the symptoms and the long-term consequences are highly associated with how well the individual is able to manage their blood glucose levels.
Mm-hmm.
So high-fiber diets have a twofold effect, basically. So one of the causes for diabetes type 2, one of the main causes is obesity, which is just long-term overconsumption of energy. Now, in a person who has a higher dietary fiber diet, they tend to be feeling full longer and eating less thereby. It's like an intuitive reaction almost. So that helps. But then even when the person does have pre-diabetes or diabetes, having fiber with the meal just slows down the curve of how fast the glucose or the sugar from the food actually reaches into the blood.
Mm.
So that helps with the control. It's a very important mechanism. And I think we've kind of, since our pharmaceutical approach has gotten so good, I think many individuals are, you know, following the advice. It's just we get away from the ability to self-regulate quite a bit just with our dietary choices. The timing of when we eat, how long we take to eat, and the foods we eat are critical components of how blood glucose responds to our eating. And I think there is a lot more that can be done to help control and maybe reduce the amount of insulin or oral agents that are taken is needed. Because I know you had a segment on diabetes and the cost to the society for diabetes treatments. It's just something to think about. We need to push it a little bit more, I think, this awareness of there is a lot the person themselves can do.
No, you're absolutely correct. You really are. Dietary changes lead to blood glucose control and prevent the symptoms of diabetes. So
yes.
That's absolutely true. You are what you eat, right? That's it.
You are what you eat. Yeah. I always start out my sessions with students about that because, you know, it's remember we grew up, you know, it's going to show our age, an apple a day keeps a doctor away.
Right.
But, you know, it's sort of those old sayings, you know, are really true. And they were basically at a time period when we didn't have all this competition in terms of the types of foods we could eat. You know, our food supply was more limited then, but it was more holistic, much better for us. And so, you know, to some degree, we can sort of understand the obesity epidemic that we're in today. It's we've caused it by having this sort of explosion of the different types of foods that sometimes are not as healthy as they should be.
Yeah, my two-minute drill is about that very thing. That's actually one of our underlying goals, if you will, is to first be the voice of the voices, you know, be the conduit for the voices like yourselves and others that we've had here to lower childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes in the community, because that obviously lower health care costs.
That, and I think we talked about changing our culture, our eating culture, and what we need to realize is that if we can teach today's children to eat healthier, those are tomorrow adults.
Absolutely.
Those are the individuals who will determine what is on the market and what can be sold and what's just not in demand anymore. So the sooner we can start this, raising a generation that just says, wait a minute, we don't want to do this anymore. We now want something else.
Yeah.
Then we have a chance. But it's a slow process.
It is.
One child at a time.
Exactly. And again, I'll go back to what you guys are doing. There's I know UVA has something called the Sustainability Initiative. As a matter of fact, I had a nice interview with Tanya Deck-LaCobb on that. The City Schoolyard Gardens and the UACC that we talked about earlier, the programs are out there, you know, and I think it's just for us to tap into what's already there, and so that's really cool.
And to have communities support them. So let me put another plug in there.
Please
The local food hub and their fresh pharmacy program,
absolutely,
which is exactly doing what we were talking about, trying to provide low-income families greater access to fresh fruits and vegetables by literally giving them fresh fruits and vegetables
food
across
justice.
The harvest season. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's, you know, anything we can do that reduces the barriers and sort of increases access to these healthier foods.
Yeah, yeah. Sans stopping the advertisers from coming in. You can't do that. You know, you can't do that. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Has been great. Really, really enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Maybe, and thanks for doing this.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. That feels good. So I get that from most of our guests. Thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're back. This is MC Blair, and I wanted to give you a headline. One egg per day boosts growth in infants. There's a study that was published on the 7th of this month in the journal Pediatrics. It concerns kids being stunted. And it affects 162 million children worldwide under the age of 5. The kids are not getting the right nutrients in order to achieve the height, weight proportion. An egg a day helps infants grow more quickly. New research shows that babies as young as 6 months develop faster when given one egg daily and have a much reduced risk of stunting, which is a serious problem that impacts 162 million children around the world under the age of 5. Now, 80 children between 6 and 9 months were given one egg per day for a year. 84 children were not given eggs, and so that established the control group. Egg eaters had 47% lower prevalence of stunting, defined as being too short for their age. Eggs contained all the amino acids, as well as choline, various growth factors, and DHA, which is a polyunsaturated fatty acid necessary for brain health. The study's author, Laura Iannotte, a researcher at Washington University in St. Louis, said it's not clear yet which of these nutrients might become the most important, but the group plans further work to find out. Initial evidence suggests choline could have an important role in growth. A gal from Johns Hopkins, Jean Humphrey, said, I think it's an exciting study. A simple intervention had a large impact on a factor, stunting, which has been recalcitrant, which means doesn't comply, doesn't obey the rules, to many other public health interventions. So stunting was recalcitrant to many other public health interventions. And she is from Johns Hopkins. Now, chickens should be pastured, not indoors, because children's growth is harmed when they're exposed to chicken feces. In the past, some worried that giving eggs to infants might lead to allergic reactions or to elevated cholesterol levels, but research has not borne either of those hypotheses out, and the food appears to be safe and healthy for infants. Well, that's really cool. That's a good thing to know. So an egg a day. Hopefully a pastured egg bought from the city market, from one of our wonderful pastured farms, like Free Union Grass Farm. And, oh, I can just go on and on and on. They're all over. Now, one of the things that Dr. Sigariz and Sybil Kranz were talking about was foods in high in dietary fiber, and I've got a list for you: raspberries, blackberries, avocados, pears, bran flakes, whole wheat pasta, pearled barley, oatmeal, split peas, lentils, black beans, lima beans, artichokes, peas, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts. So there you go. That's a nice list for foods high in dietary fiber. So I would say, you know, if your kids like cereals, possibly bran flakes or a good whole grain flake with blackberries or raspberries on there, or oatmeal with some raspberries or blackberries. Lots of good things that they can eat during the day. So that's pretty important. So we've got lots of ways. I've read where communities have gotten financial support from their local government to supplement the local college's food budget or local school's food budget, allowing them to purchase more local food, which, of course, has them participating in the community with the local farms and the community as a whole. And that is so key, is the whole community participating in a project to get the kids more healthy, and in turn, the adults will be more healthy. And you have, when the community works together in a project, especially a focused project, you have people from different income strata, you have people with different cultures, and people with different skin colors coming together, and thus you have a more unified community. And man, is that important. And what that will do, once the little communities get organized and working together, then they'll go into the stores, they'll go into the pharmacies, they'll go into their doctor's offices and spread that word. So next thing you know, the doctors and the pharmacists, of course, they have kids, a lot of them, and they'll be participating as parents, and that will influence that whole, you know, that whole segment of, quote, Western medicine, where heretofore it's been, you know, pills and surgery, right? I mean, so I hate to say it. I know a doctor, and I asked him about that, and he said, we are so busy charting, which is, you know, whenever you go to the doctor, they're usually on a computer nowadays, and they're writing down the notes about what you say and about what your history is and all that. And then after you leave, after the office, quote, closes, they have to stay there and translate all that into a master chart. So by the time they get off work at 8, 9 o'clock at night and they get to their families, number one, they're dog tired. And they don't have the motivation, a lot of them, or the time, especially if they have a family, to do the research. So they're sort of cut off, and they're dependent on pharmaceutical representatives to keep them abreast of what's the latest. Well, obviously, a pharmaceutical representative, and it's nothing against them personally, but the company, the pharmaceutical industry, doesn't make money. And it needs to make money to keep going and to pay their stockholders. And so unless the doctors are writing the prescriptions for all the pills and all the medications for these maladies, diseases, they're not making money. And so when the pharmaceutical rep talks to the doctor, they're going to talk about how their medicine fits the latest study, fits the profile, and this is what they should be writing. As opposed to saying, you know, the doctor doing their own research and telling the patient, hey, look, meet me at City Market, you know, this Saturday, and I'll show you the farms where you need to be shopping and the foods you need to be buying, which, you know, if they become less obese or they'll become healthier and getting the nutrients they need, they're not going to need the pills. They're not going to need the surgery, and also of course your copays will go down. And I used to say when I had a little kitchen there and I was selling my local pork barbecue, pulled pork, pastured barbecue sandwiches. And I would say, well, how come it's so expensive for the sandwich? And I'd say, well, you can either pay me now or pay your doctor later, which is, there's a lot of truth to that, folks. There's a lot of truth to that. So if you're eating the right foods and especially sourcing them locally in season, then you're going to be healthier and see the doctor less. And so obviously your healthcare costs will go down. By the way, I discovered this method of freezing local broccoli in season so that I can have it, my family can have it year round, even when it's not in season. And it's really simple. You just take a nice pot, you salt it to where it's fairly salty, not quite seawater, but you know, it you can taste that salt. Then you bring it to a boil. You blanch the broccoli between 3 and 4 minutes. You fill your sink with water. You put get a bag of ice or get some ice, make a nice ice bath. You put the broccoli immediately into that ice bath, and that'll stop the cooking. It'll be nice and bright green. Then lay it out on some towels. Let it dry, let up most of the water get out of there. Then you can vacuum seal it, or if you don't have a vacuum sealer, just take a baggie, a gallon baggie, or a quart baggie, enough for a couple of days for your family. No more than that, all right? Because once it's blanched, it doesn't last more than a couple of days in the refrigerator. A couple of days in each bag, and if it's just a baggie, you can seal it almost all the way with a straw in one end and suck as much air out of it as you can, and then, you know, hit that seal real quick as you extract the straw. And you can freeze that, and in the wintertime, go ahead and, you know, 2 days at a time, pull one out, defrost it, and you've got broccoli for your family, and it's local. And about as fresh as you can get. I mean, it way better than frozen broccoli in the grocery store from Chile or California or whatever. And you know, by doing this, as more and more people do it, and with City Schoolyard Gardens and the Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville, these educational groups that are teaching children and urban families how to grow their own food and the value of the fresh and local food, eventually, I believe that we can, as a community, develop our own local food system capable of supporting greater than 50% of the population. And actually, if we got to that point, it would continue, and pretty soon it might be 75 or 80% eating local foods and participating in these programs that will make the community healthy. It's absolutely amazing what can be done if the community gets together and does it. You know, because the many chemical fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and other chemicals in the mainstream food system, there's a major contributing factor in the weakening of the overall health of our children. And what I just cited, that's how it can be changed, you know, with the community working together, and which will also be an outreach for less fortunate families and show them how they can afford this really real food, good healthy food, by participating and helping to grow and getting food for help, if you will. That's one of the ways that the families that are less fortunate, just by volunteering and then also going to the local farms. Many of the local farms have your pick your own programs, which you're allowed to do, and you go and you get your own, and it's sometimes it's absolutely free, and other times it's way less expensive than going to the grocery store. And wow, isn't that good? that's just unbelievable. And so I am going to finish off with my two-minute drill for today. The 40 years from the late 50s to the late 90s was when the U.S. government started to, with the best of intentions, encourage the factory farm model through farm subsidies and tax breaks for participating farms. Today, we're faced with the logical result of another case of changing the natural order of things. Big ag and big meat, corporate control of our food system is a recipe for disaster because the corporate model dictates profit over everything else, as opposed to a local farmer who practices taking care of the soil, his water use, and the general health of the produce and meat products, and it will result in better health of the people, not only physically, but also a community with a general commitment to work together. And I want to stress that. It's the commitment to work together that will make this work. Now, this, of course, will take time, and we here at To Your Health are committed to helping the many true food citizens. Like Michael from Edible Landscaping, and you know, other farms, most of the farmers around here, and a lot of people with the sustainability initiative at UVA, Dr. Sybil Kranz and Dr. Anna Marie Sigariz are food citizens, you know, because they know it's so important. They know the importance through their research that this is something that needs to get out to the public. The move toward local food began in the 60s with the organic food movement. Now, concerns about the health and environmental risks associated with synthetic fertilizers and pesticides were not the only reason they chose to grow foods organically. It was about a commitment to treating the whole farm as a living organism, not just a profit center. Now, they can make good money at a local farm, but that's not their goal. Their goal is to treat the farm as a whole, the soil and the water and all that, treating their workers well with a living wage and working with the community at large. And that's the key. Now, big farming corporations have gotten into the organic market, but that's not the point. To be truly healthful, food needs to be raised locally by a farmer who believes the before-mentioned principles, those of soil health, carbon sequestration, and being part of the whole. So let's do this, listeners. Let's research how we can become involved. look up the local, the Food Justice Network, and decide which of the many participating organizations you can donate to or volunteer for. You will be rewarded in ways yet unimagined. I want to thank Dr. Anna Maria Sigariz and Dr. Sybil Kranz for their research regarding the first 1,000 days of children's lives and how increasing dietary fiber and reducing added sugar can provide a stable, healthy platform for the rest of their lives. And I also want to thank all of you who have downloaded our show. I hope something you hear sparks the desire to know more. Remember, participating in community activities, treating your bodies with care, and eating real foods are keys to your health.
You've been listening to Your Health with your host, MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.